I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking hour?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
To the Welsh international John Toshack. Toshack, Keegan, 1-0. Hughes, Hooks, Toshack, Keegan, 2-0.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. Joining myself and Jonathan Wilson today is Tony Evans, football writer and former sports editor at The Times, currently with The Independent and author of Two Tribes, among other titles. Tony, thank you very much for coming in.
A pleasure.
The pleasure is all ours, as they say. We're going back to 1973. It's the UEFA Cup final first leg between Liverpool and Borussia Mönchengladbach. Liverpool won 3-0 and would go on to lose the second leg 2-0, but of course triumph 3-2 on aggregate. But we're looking at the first leg specifically. Why have you gone for this game, Tony?
Well, it was Liverpool's first European trophy. It was the peak of Shankly's second coming. So to rebuild the team after the great mid-60s side. And I was 12 years old, and it was just one of the greatest things in the world to go with a match and, you know, have a biblical rainstorm and then a match of equally epic proportions the next night.
Yeah, and obviously the result of that game would just about see them over the line, Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, I think this the rebuilding aspect is what maybe the has been slightly lost in the mists of time to sort of the wider public. And yeah, you sort of see, we've seen this season with, say, Pochettino struggling, that one side has come to an end and either, yeah, he's got to go or the squad's got to be rebuilt.
At the time of recording, he's still in the job.
At the time of recording, he's still in the job, yeah. But it occurs, I mean, the conversation in those days was very different. I mean, nobody presumably in the late 60s would talk about Shankly having come to an end, having taken the team as far as he could. What were they?
Well, there was a little bit of it. I mean, again, these things were airbrushed out of history. Before they won anything in Shankly's first couple of years, there were complaints from the supporters club, you know, wanting rid of him, didn't think he was good enough. And there was grumbling. It wasn't massive grumbling. There's no social media. There isn't Twitter for people to form an online lynch mob for the manager. but there were still complaints. And I think Pochettino is a good example now. You know, you see it with managers, even Shankly. There'll come a point where the players, who, if they've been with them long enough, stop listening. You know, the shtick wears, you know, thin on them, and you need to either change the players at that point or change the manager. And Shankly stayed loyal with the players from the mid-60s team too long and really put himself in jeopardy at that point. It's a very difficult thing. Shankly is one of the great motivators. And I had a conversation once with Peter Wall, who played for Liverpool and Crystal Palace. So he played under Shankly, Malcolm Allison and Terry Venables. And he said the difference in them, he said, Shankly could make you believe. He said, mm-hmm. He could make you believe all the time. He said, Allison could do it for 1 year. He said, but the second year, you'd heard it all before. Only kids believed. He said, and Venables was quite different. He just instructed you about the game and your opponents, and there was no, it wasn't a case of belief. But that's the problem for most managers. The players, they stop listening to them at some point.
So where would you say that the point in which his first great team, where would you say they come to the end? The 66 Cup Winners' Cup final, is that their sort of the final peak? Or
yeah, that's, you know, that's probably where they should have won the first European trophy. And after that,
and they get done by a really freakish deflection. Yeah, lose 2-1 in extra time, was it?
Yeah, it was.
So
yeah.
Labadia,
Borussia Dortmund.
Yeah, Labadia's shot takes a big deflection, goes in, lose 2-1. And then it starts, they won the cup the year before, they won the league the year before that. Mm. But then after 66, it starts to dip.
Yeah, and to be fair, it was a very competitive league. You know, United won the title the next year and then went on to win the European Cup. You know, Manchester City won the title. They were very good. Everton were good. They'd win it in, you know, sort of 1970. So there was a lot of good teams around. It was a very, very competitive division.
Well, there's eight different champions in the 60s, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Leeds were probably the great underrated team from 65 to 75 in British history, because, I mean, they hit the bar on the double almost every year, and they were a fantastic team, and we kind of forget them.
Yeah.
But
so another team that was allowed to grow altogether.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's a problem, right? Especially for, I guess, in those days when you have a manager who comes in and sort of it becomes like his extended family. Mm. It's not that sort of slightly distant relationship you have now.
Yeah, I mean, It was, you know, so that Shankly became, and he admitted it, too emotionally involved with a lot of the players. And then, of course, when he dropped them with stunning brutality.
Well, that story of Ian St. John, is it at Newcastle when he drops him for the first time?
Yeah, yeah.
And he basically kind of goes missing in the corridors, and St. John finds out when the team sheet's handed round that he doesn't even tell him face to face.
Oh, yeah, I mean, for all the strengths, Shankly, you know, he didn't front the players on things like this.
It's funny, because you wouldn't think that of a man like Shankly.
No.
You think he would be very comfortable in saying to someone's face, "You're not playing today, son."
Yeah, I think he found it very hard to. I mean, he could be very nasty and very sure.
I'm sure, people, yeah.
But I think he found it hard to disappoint people who he liked.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a, you know, very strange character. I mean, I used to go up the grounds in these school holidays, and you would wait outside, you know, for the players come back from Melwood, you know, to come off, get all their autographs, and then go in, have some lunch, and come out. And so Shankly'd always be last out, so he'd wait for him. And he'd come out and he'd sort of say, I can't stop today, boys, I'm in a hurry. And you'd always get him, Mike, and you'd say, Bill, you know, is George Best the best player you've ever seen? He'd go, the boy's good. He's good. What? No, he's good. So who's the best you've ever seen? He'd say, there's a lot of good players. So he'd be getting in his car, and you'd say, what was Finney like, Tom? Stop. So what was Finney like, Bill? He'd stop. He'd go, Tommy was the best. And that was it. You had him for half an hour.
Really?
You know, he was this like sort of strange, he was sort of charismatic, but deeply human in many ways.
Very sensitive, you could say.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a word you wouldn't normally have around the chat about Bill Shankly.
You know, outside that, you know, gruff granite Scottish mine and exterior, you know, he was, and things like my mate's family lived on the corner of the Kemlin Road, and on match day, you know, things would get thrown into the yard and all that. And his mother would always be round complaining to Peter Robinson, you know. And if she got no satisfaction there, she'd go round and grab Shankly. And he'd sort it out, you know. I mean, there's loads of stories like that. He was a very strange character. But, you know, as I say, deeply, deeply human. You know, the stories of women who couldn't get council housing, coming up and asking them to do something, them going downtown with them to their housing office and banging on the door.
He's like a councillor.
Yeah, he was, you know, he's... He was really deeply involved with everything that went on around him. But the players say it was strange when he comes to drop them. Although the best story about St. John was when he realised he was on the way out. The famous Christmas story. The tables of turkeys, and the first team had big plump birds, and, you know, sort of the reserves had little scrawny ones. And St. John goes up to get his big plump one. They go, no, Saint. You're over there.
Oh, no.
the moment at which he sort of is forced to accept this first great team has come to an end is the defeat to Watford in the FA Cup in 1970?
Yes.
And Watford at the time was sort of lower end of the second division, so a big shock. And then once the change happens, it's very rapid.
Yeah. He's again, he might have lingered too long, but once he knew he had to act, he was decisive and... And, you know, within a year, they were in the cup final against Arsenal, got beat, and, you know, bringing new players, and he'd signed Keegan just before the cup final, and suddenly a new team was developing. And there were some of the old faces, the mainstays. I mean, you know, Tommy Smith remains, but, you know, the likes of Ron Yates, Peter Thompson, Roger Hunt, St. John.
Tommy Lawrence, yep.
Clemens come in. So it was very, very much a... much more youthful team, and the football was a bit more sophisticated than the 60s team.
Mm. Keegan was a crucial signing, of course. I mean, he was the, would you, reluctant to say, but like the ones that the golden boy of that team, perhaps, or is that a bit too much?
Oh, he was the golden boy of English football. He was.
Well, then German football a few years later.
Yeah, I mean, he come in and he had a sensational impact. I don't think even Shankly thought he was going to have the impact he did.
Mm-hmm.
He'd come in from Scunthorpe, and, you know, there were a couple of people interested in him, but not, you know, he wasn't one of those players that everyone was desperate to get. And I remember being at his debut against Nottingham Forest at Anfield, and he scored early on. And I was like, wow, what have we got here?
It was quite a long break between him signing and playing, though, wasn't it? Didn't he have sort of a six-month gap or something while he sort of got himself used to the environment?
Well, he signed just before the cup final.
Right.
So it's...
So it was just over the summer,
yeah,
as he was,
so
right.
Yeah, over the summer, yeah.
Yeah, Liverpool in those days, but they were playing a 4-3-3 more, am I right in saying? I mean, it's sometimes difficult to pin it down.
I think they were very flexible.
Right.
You know, I think it was... He would have thought of it in terms of a 4-4-2.
Okay.
But getting the midfielders forward as soon as possible.
Uh-huh.
I think... Given the way football tactics were, it's hard to pin down. Exactly.
Yeah, okay, yeah, no, I appreciate that. Yeah.
And certainly as a 12-year-old, I cared little for that.
I'm sure. And of course, going into that UEFA Cup final, and we should say that...
Well, Liverpool had finished third in 72.
Yes.
And then, yeah, they get to the UEFA Cup final, beat Tottenham in the semi-final.
Yep. And Tottenham were the holders because they'd beaten Wolves in the previous, which was the first sort of iteration of the UEFA Cup, having been the Fairs Cup in, what, 71, something like that, early 70s. And Liverpool, they win the league before going into this UEFA Cup final. So Shankly, he was back on top in England again.
Yeah, and remember, the previous year, they were very close to winning the league.
Final game.
Yeah, had a goal disallowed as Arsenal. And... late on in a 0-0 draw, that would have given them the title.
Yeah.
So
that's the famous instance when Derby are all on holiday and there's Peter Taylor on the phone, finding out what the score is, telling Clough, we've won it.
That's right, yeah.
They were knocking on the door again then, and they were getting better, they were improving. You know, you could tell they were, sort of, they were on the way. And it's, but Europe was like, Europe was the holy grail to Shankly, and you know, and he hates up foreigners. You know, what I mean? He thought they were all dastardly cheats, and you know, it's and he hated going abroad.
Well, I mean, he thought they were dastardly cheats with a level of justification, given what had happened in the European Cup semi-final in '65, the Inter game when. I mean, there's no doubt, is there, that was a game that was fixed?
Hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, clearly Inter paid off the referee. However, Liverpool's self-destruction was one of the key components in that. I mean, if you look at the if you look at the stuff on YouTube about it, I mean, you know, you talk about Keane and the United players surrounds and referees, and you know, and everyone looks at that. That's the way Liverpool roughed up the referee. Clearly they thought he was a cheat, and they kicked him, beat him, you know. So and they lost all discipline. You know, the game was gone within 15 minutes of kickoff.
So Liverpool won the first leg 2-0 at home, went to San Siro, and then of the three goals Inter scored, one was an indirect free kick that went straight in and was given, and one Tommy Lawrence was sort of bouncing the ball and the player sort of nicks it off him.
Yeah, Tommy Lawrence claims he had it kicked out of his hands. He didn't. You know, it was just
it was an unfortunate one.
Yeah, he switched off. He lost concentration, and as a result of the first goal, and that was it. Oh. So
it should be said, we know that Dessa Schulte, the Hungarian fixer, who appears in my book, the name said long ago,
and what a book it is. I'd advise it to anyone.
Thank you very much. I mean, this is not about Schulte. Schulte's story is incredible.
Yeah.
Survived Auschwitz. Yeah, and then. Goes into match fixing. He's an astonishing figure, but it cost Liverpool. And so I can understand why Shankly and I think Clough had very similar opinions, were very, very sceptical of, Italians in particular.
Yeah, and we should say about the UEFA Cup that it was a big deal. I know that some people might think, nowadays Champions League and so on. Well, you know, it really was a worthwhile trophy throughout its sort of history. I mean, a few of the bigger nations had three teams in the competition. Most sort of nations had two, but some of the, I think that
there's more good teams in the UEFA Cup than there were in the Champions Cup.
Yeah,
you can win the Champions Cup by beating one or two good teams. The UEFA Cup, you were going to play three or four good teams.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, England, West Germany, and Italy all had four teams in it. And that season, England had Man City, Spurs, Liverpool, and Stoke City. But it was might be a fanciful one, but as you say, there could be an argument the UEFA Cup was just as good to win as maybe even the European Cup.
Well, without a doubt, it was seen as a stepping stone to winning the European Cup, and so it was harder to win.
Yeah.
So once you won that, there was a sense of you could go on and win the European Cup.
Well, it's more like the Champions League now, as you say, Jonathan. Yeah. For those reasons, you don't have the best.
So you maybe have three or four genuinely great sides wouldn't be in it, but you'd have a long list of really, really good teams.
And all the up-and-coming teams are in it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, after the break, we'll get into the match itself. Stay with us.
Floated high, Lloyd! 3-0!
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Welcome back to Greatest Games, everybody, on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. Right, gentlemen, let's talk about the match itself. There was an awful lot of rain in Liverpool leading up to the game, but the game did kick off. The referee said, no, let's go ahead. But it only lasted 27 minutes, Tony.
Yeah, it was wet. we were soaked through. I used to go on stands. I was in the Anfield Road, so on the main stand side, quite near the corner flag, and get there.
So sort of where the away fans would be now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I get there, you know, that night, come home, straight home from school, changed, up the grounds, waiting, queuing to get in. So you're in there. So absolutely soaked. But, you know, it was a European final. You know, for me, it was, I'd never seen anything like it before. So I was really excited. And the game kicked off and the rain came down. It was, it really was. Ridiculous, and the play was, I mean, the ball wasn't running. You know, you could tell they'd have to call it off, and Shankly picked in the team. He picked Brian Hall. The idea was he thought Gunter Netzer would be coming, range him forward, and Hall could, one, close him down, and two, get behind him.
And you know, Chubby said the British football had a, I guess, a terror and huge admiration of Netzer, because Netzer had orchestrated West Germany's demolition of England at Wembley the previous year. So there's a sense of Netzer is the future of football. He is the greatest player. We've got to be incredibly careful about him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, so Netzer was one of the latest incarnations of total football, and had this long flowing hair, and everyone wanted to be him. I remember after he destroyed England at Wembley, you know, in school, everyone was running, like, going there and going, Gunter Netzer! You know, everyone wanted to be like him. So, yeah, we living in fear of him, and Shankly did that. And perversely, Mönchengladbach sat deep, and with Netzer, very, very deep. And
well, they played Netzer as a sweeper, yeah, alongside, bizarrely, Rainer Bonhof, who also, I think, is better known as a midfielder.
Yeah, two of the greatest midfielders of the era were sitting deep. And you know, you couldn't really see a pattern of play being established, because the water just stopped the ball running. But one thing was clear: they'd come to park the bus, as we'd say in the modern terminology, and go back to Germany and look for a result.
And presumably the idea of playing these two sort of ball-playing midfielders as the two centre-backs was, they're going to keep the ball. We're not going to give the ball away cheaply. Mm. If we sit the team deep enough, then you know, the fact that neither of them are particularly good in the air isn't really going to matter. Yeah. Except it turns out it really does matter.
And flood the areas where Keegan will be likely to roam, because they were clearly worried about Keegan.
Yeah, in 77, when Liverpool played Mönchengladbach in the European Cup final, Bertie Vogt went man-to-man on Keegan. Was there any idea of that here? Or
No. I think from what I can remember, they just flooded the area and shifted, you know, from zone to zone. Uh-huh. So it's and Keegan didn't get a lot of space, and the Liverpool, well, you couldn't get a low width, because the wings in particular were like paddling pools.
Right.
So there was little you could really glean from it.
Well, but Shankly did take something from it, didn't he? So the game was called off after 27 minutes, and he realised that Gladbach were vulnerable to a high ball in the air. Mm-hmm. So he for the kind of the restart, if you like, of the first leg. Was it played the next day?
The next night, yeah. So it was played the next night, and it was Tempe to get in. So you either used your tickets if you were the stands, or because everyone had paid at the gate, 10p to get in. So it was even more crucial to get there. And funnily enough, less people show with the second night, bizarrely. And you'd think, because I think most of the city went, oh, 10p to get in, like everyone will go, we'll never get in.
Yeah.
And the next night, he picked Toshak instead of Brian Hall. And
I mean, had it been a surprise at Hall? I know you explained tactically why he'd done that, but had it been a surprise that Toshak had been left out for the first game?
Absolute shock. And Toshak had a real hissy fit.
Well, for those who don't know, I mean, how important was Toshak? Because he was the centre forward, wasn't he, for the side?
Yeah, Toshak was, you know, sort of, really, he was the pivot for the forward line. Knock the ball into him, he'd knock it down. You know, the runners would go around, and particularly Keegan, and he'd feed off him. And he was dominant in the air. He was, you know, a great presence in the air.
Mm-hmm.
But he, you know, sort of the day the second game, the Toshak stormed out, demanded a transfer, and you know, so that's not very good going into a game. Shankly apparently phoned him and said, "Now get yourself some rest, lad. You're playing tonight."
But didn't he accuse Shankly of having let Paisley pick the team or something? As if Paisley was seen as being, yeah, a bit too clever, trying to do, yeah, you know, messing around with things at work, trying to kind of, you know, overthink things.
Yeah, because he'd been over there watching Mönchengladbach and come back with, you know, some ideas, and Toshak was lashing out, blaming everyone, and then he gets picked back in the team, and then all of a sudden everything's fine. For poor Brian Hall,
yeah,
again, the classic Shankleyism, he didn't pull him aside at lunchtime and say, "Look, had a look at them. You know, we need some height in there. Sorry about that." And Brian Hall was very short. You know, Brian Hall found out when the team sheet went up, which obviously was, you know, he was looking forward to the biggest game of his life.
True.
He got 27 minutes the day before, and that was it. Uh-huh. And so he had an explosion at Shankly before the match. So it wasn't it wasn't sweetness and light in the dressing room,
clearly.
That's for sure.
But it was an important decision to put in Toshak, because the next sort of restart, if you like, of this first leg, Liverpool just bombarded them.
Yeah, everything was in the air. It was, you know, Toshak set up Keegan twice, you know, early on. Larry Lloyd again in the air, big hulking centre half, who incidentally Shankly changed the team later after the Red Star Belgrade defeat in the European Cup, because he said you
which is
win.
The following season, yeah, later that year, but yeah, what, November 73?
Yeah. He said you couldn't win the European Cup with a defender like Larry Lloyd, so he brought Phil Thompson in. Of course, Larry Lloyd goes on to win two European Cups. So, you know, it's...
Indeed.
But yes, yeah, so 21 minutes in, the first goal, Lawler cross, Toshak wins the header, heads it back across goal, and a brilliant diving header from Keegan to make it 1-0. And so that's already, there's the proof that picking Toshak was the right decision. And you see then, almost immediately, just how mentally shot Gladbach are by this. By, is it Bertie Vogt concedes a penalty?
Yes.
Just, I mean, it's Callahan's ball in and just jumps and punches the ball
was
away.
Was it Vogt or Bonhoff? I can't remember who it was.
I think it's Vogt, but okay. I could be wrong.
Sure.
So punches it away.
Ridiculous handball.
Yeah.
Does he get both fists on it?
Yeah, both hands
on
it.
I mean, normally a ridiculous handball from a defender is you go up and they have a rush of blood and they put their hand out to just flick it off the forward's head. Both fists for a defender.
Oh, and there's no doubt this is, you know, there's no way you can say, oh, he just sort of jumped, that's where
it
his hand was.
Absolute madness.
It's like he's playing volleyball or something.
And I've not seen anything like it.
It's such a bizarre thing that Toshak, who's right next to him, putting pressure on him, only sort of half appeals and he goes off chasing the ball, as if Toshak himself can't quite believe what he's just seen. Like, well, that can't actually have happened. So,
Toshak really got into the mines. He was bullying them, he was pushing them all around the pitch. And they just couldn't cope with his physicality.
No. But then Keegan misses the penalty.
Yeah,
the
good save. Goalkeeper makes a very good save. Down to the right.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. But then, what, 8 minutes later, I think, Keegan makes it 2-0. And again, it's the high ball into the box. Gladbach are just all over the place.
Yeah.
They just can't deal with it.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a long straight free kick from Tommy Smith on the halfway line. And the ball just bobs about until eventually it falls to Toshak to head it down for a Keegan volley. So it's, yeah, the same link up again. But yeah, if a penalty weren't enough to say Gladbach have completely lost this, yeah, that proved it, because they had sort of four or five chances to clear it. Well, that just kept heading it back in the air again.
I mean, that goal, the scene for that goal, what we now know in big European finals, and you think of, you know, the beautiful green grass, you know, the two very sort of cultured players and so on. And they were cultured players, don't get me wrong, in that game. But the pitch is all over the place because of all the rain. The way it's bobbling around, it just doesn't, that goal in particular doesn't come across as a big European final.
Yeah, and let's face it, most pitches in...
Oh, yeah.
You know, by that time of year, were a right mess. And when they had so much rain dumped on them, they were terrible, you know. That ball in from Smith is, you know, it's a nil-advised free kick. It's a bit of a point you'd expect any sort of defender or midfielder, no matter how short they are, to deal with that ball easily, and they don't.
Yeah, because there's no angle on it. It's just straight.
Yeah.
And I think that just does show that... And I guess in that sense, in 99% of circumstances, it would be ill-advised. In this circumstance, it's exactly right. Just keep bombing it in.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they looked... You know, at half-time, you were thinking, oh, we'll get 6 or 7 against these, you know, the... So all over the place.
Yeah. Well, they had to wait until about the 60th minute when, as you say, Larry Lloyd scored. And
completely unmarked from the corner. Like, I mean,
yeah,
incredible something get that much space, what, 7-8 yards out?
Yeah.
But there's no pressure on them at all.
Well, having had so many warnings and goals conceded beforehand as well. And it was interesting because I think David Coleman says on the commentary, look again at this defence, hopeless in the air. And when the commentator has pointed out for everybody to see, then you wonder why maybe they didn't sort of switch things up a bit, or... I don't know, just get everybody back.
It's a different game, though, in terms of subs. And
well, I suppose,
they've taken a risk by playing Netzer and Bonhoff. I don't know what other defenders they had in the squad who could have come in. But, you just think what a favour it did Liverpool that Toshak didn't play that first night, so he didn't get the chance to change it. Because it could easily have been the other way around.
Oh, without
a doubt. They suddenly thought, oh, Christ, we need whoever we got, he's 6'4" and a bruiser to deal with this.
Yeah, and you said, Tony, that everyone thought, oh, it's going to be sort of 6 or 7. I mean, at 3-0 up, still half an hour to play, they're thinking, I mean, was there an air of, we'll kill this game off, or was it kind of like, well, this is done? What was the feeling?
Well, they were a good side. I mean, despite the problems at the back, they could pass the ball out very well and very quickly. And so there was a kind of a little bit of a worry that they'd get one back. And, you know, they almost did.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, 5 minutes after that, Joop Hanks has a penalty, which brilliantly saved by Clemens.
So, I mean, it's a clumsy tackle by Howie on
it
down
was.
There.
Yeah.
I mean, my theory is that West Germany invented diving as we understand it now. That was a foul, it was a penalty.
Yeah.
But Danner goes down like a man who's used to diving, could we say.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you might be onto something there about West Germany.
Oh, Beckenbauer was a nightmare for it. I know my dislike of Beckenbauer was strong before, but...
Yeah, I'm amazed we've managed to squeeze that into this episode.
What a whited sepulchre that man is. Well, you know, the contrast between him and Netzer I find fascinating, because Netzer was seen as sort of the wild child with his leather jacket and his long hair, where you've got the Christian Democrat Beckenbauer with his very neat hair and... Mm. Yeah, Netzer's the one who married a woman in the mid-70s and is still with her.
Yeah.
Beckenbauer's the one who was having court cases about things that may or may not have happened in cupboards.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah. But my only issue is the hypocrisy of it. But
yeah.
Anyway, how did we get into that?
No, I think you needed to get that out. But yes, the game ended 3-0. And at the final whistle, I suppose Liverpool...
Well, and the penalty save that Clemens made from Hanks turned out to be absolutely vital.
Completely.
Well, he said he'd seen him on telly take a penalty kick and so he decided to go the same way. And he said, oh, so my homework paid off. Okay, Ray.
Yeah, well, he kept it out. Liverpool won 3-0. Then what was the feeling then, Tony? Well, a job well done?
Well, 3-0, you think that should be it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's quite funny. Tommy Smith, sort of after the match, was being interviewed. He said, you know, are you pleased? You know, you've got a 3-0 lead to take to Germany. He said, yeah, it's better than being 3-0 down. You know, so, I mean, it's... you know, you think, oh, they're going to win it.
Yeah.
It didn't quite turn... Well, win it easily, it didn't quite turn out that way.
I mean, yeah, they did win it, but as you say, it wasn't nearly as comfortable as they'd have hoped, because at half-time in that second leg, Liverpool were 2-0 down.
Yeah.
And Joop Hanck scored, what did he get, 2? The second one he certainly got was a lovely finish.
Well, they're both lovely goals. I mean, the first one's Bonhoff's cut back to him. Uh-huh. The second one, as you say, is brilliant curling finish. Yeah, I was just sort of looking at the team for that second leg. They brought in Surau, to play alongside Vogt at centre back. So Vogt moved from full. I mean, Vogt was a great man, Mark. Really. Yeah. He wasn't particularly tall. So they played Vogt and Surow in the middle. Bonhoff went to right back. And Danner, who played on the wing in the first leg, dropped to left back. And then Netz was able to go back into the midfield. So I think there's only one player different, but they've shuffled them around.
Well,
which I guess is a total footballing principle, so they can play in a multitude of positions.
Yeah, when you talk to the players of that era, they suggest that the best man for them that night, though, was the ref, because he penalised everything Toshak did. He, you know,
The Soviet, Pavel Kazakov.
Yes, every time he jumped, he'd blow a whistle for it. You know, he wasn't letting Toshak win anything in the air. And they all say he was their best defender.
But Liverpool, they got over the line.
At half time, apparently they say they were completely exhausted. They'd been run all over the place. They'd never had to chase them like that for a long time. Shankly was, don't worry, they've blown themselves out. And you know, they all say, well, you know he's wrong, but you have to believe.
Well, they held on though.
But I mean, Shankly was a master of that, though, wasn't he? I mean, didn't he after Ajax had beaten Liverpool? Was it 5-1 or 5-0? The game in 1966, was it 5-1?
Yeah, 5-1.
And you know, his claim after that game, they're a very defensive side who only play on the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seemed to work.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you know, the man was a disgrace, but he could make them believe. You know,
but they won it. They, you know, when all said and done, Shankly took them to that victory. So they'd won the old first division and the UEFA Cup in the same year. It was a remarkable year.
Yeah.
Possible, would you say it was his best year as a manager?
Oh, without a doubt. That right. I think it was the peak of his powers, really.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of, you know, he produced a team, you know, within 2 years that is a completely different style to the ones that have gone before, which, you know, would go on to dominate Europe. And, you know, he did it at a time when a lot of people were suspecting that he passed the sell-by date.
Yeah. I mean, so in that regard, how big a shock or how significant was that defeat to Red Star that in the Champions Cup that November?
Well, I think everyone just thought, and I think Shankly thought, oh, well, you know, we've won this. This is, you know, we've beaten Mönchengladbach, who are as good a team as there is in Europe. You know what? Next year, you know, the European Cup, yeah, that'll be easy. And then they gave us a lesson.
So both legs were 2-1, but yeah. It was the gulf between the sides was greater than that.
Oh, they just pinged the ball around, and Liverpool couldn't get near them. You know, I remember being at Anfield, couldn't believe what I was seeing. You know, they couldn't get close to them to foul them.
Yeah, and then Shankly himself, of course, he won the league, won the UEFA Cup, and he only stayed the season after. I mean, presumably to have a go at the European Cup. Mm. But then they did finish on a high, winning the FA Cup.
Well, and some of the football in the final minutes of that FA Cup final is amazing. And a famous clip of him on the bench doing the hand gestures. The very Benitez hand gestures, actually.
I think Rafa would be flattered by the comment.
I'm sure he would be. But yeah, then Shankly, he was done. He retired. You know, what you were talking about earlier about being so invested emotionally in everybody, it just kind of caught up with him, really, I suppose.
Yeah, and he also was a serial resigner. You know, he was always resigning. So at this point, the board just got enough. I remember one of those, you know, the cliche, everyone remembers where they were when Kennedy was shot. Kennedy, when Shankly resigned, and like the words.
So where were you?
I was in school, and one of the teachers come running into the classroom. Shankly's gone. You know,
Evertonians cheering, perhaps.
No, because Evertonians quite liked it, and the relationship between the clubs wasn't like it is now.
Sure, okay.
It was it was much more cordial and. People were wandering around, wandering home from school in a state of shock. Going, how can this have happened?
But I mean, do you think? I mean, is it too easy to say that it was necessary for Shankly to go for Liverpool to have the European domination they subsequently had?
Well, probably it was probably the time for a natural evolution, and you know, Paisley was much more sophisticated as a tactician and a manager than Shankly. You know, And you could argue that he had the better eye for a player and got a better blend. If history would have been different and Shankly stays, do they go on to have that sort of late 70s, early 80s dominance? Maybe not.
Yeah. I mean, there's the famous programme notes, isn't there, that Paisley wrote before, was it Fenerbahce they were playing, or Ferencváros?
Ferencváros.
Where he says, you know, we have to learn from the Red Star game, our football's going to be different. Mm. It may look very cautious, but please don't get impatient.
Yeah.
Which is an extraordinary thing for a manager to write. But I guess, actually a very smart sort of political thing to do, to say to the fans, actually, this is on you as much as it's on us. You've got to play your part here.
Paisley was very good at that. He did a different sort of publicity to Shankly. Shankly did the PR, the bombastic, and, you know, sort of made everyone laugh. Paisley was very cautious, but he'd always do what he called giving them a bit of toffee. give them something to chew on, but, like, it's actually largely meaningless. So he'd do that, you know, get the...
But do you think those programme notes were meaningless, or was that actually...
Yeah, I kind of think he was giving the fans something to chew on to make them... Yeah, not meaningless in the sense. I think he achieved what he suggested he was trying to do, and putting us on the fans. But I don't think he cares one way or the other deep down. You know, he had the way he was going to do things, and no one was going to make him do anything different.
But that's But then I suppose with the notes, as you say, he's wanting to say that, but just not sound blunt. And Anfield's such a fortress in general, but in European nights. And he thought, well, if we can get it onside as well, have a bit of patience, I suppose.
Yeah, and you know, there were plenty of people who weren't prepared to be patient. I mean, in his first season, when he didn't win anything, the Echo letters page was full of people saying, you know, he was the wrong choice. You know, they wanted St. John. They wanted, all manner of people, but, you know, they thought Paisley was the...
How well-known a figure was Paisley before he got the job? Was he? I mean, because he seemed such a figure who sort of was so reluctant to be in the limelight. So, and was he well-known as an assistant? Or
no, he was just one of those... I mean, Shankly sucked in all the attention, and Shankly was the one who, you know, he personified the place. So everyone else was in his shadow. So, no, Paisley was a bit of a, certainly as I remember it, and as I say, I was very young, but I remember, you know, it's like a bit like, is he going to be up to it? You know, we didn't know much about him.
But to just bring it back to the 73 UEFA Cup win, crucial for Shankly's legacy, because as you say, mid-60s, brilliant, you know, teams won a couple of league titles in FA Cup and then... A few years without winning a trophy.
And the two near misses in Europe. The semi-final, about which is a load of bitterness, and then the very unfortunate defeat to Dortmund in the Cup Winners' Cup final.
Yeah.
So they've had a sniff of it and haven't quite got there.
But to win that European trophy in the same year they won the league as well. That I mean, not that his place was ever in doubt. Not that that name would ever be forgotten or sort of tarnished in any way. But for that season towards the end of his reign was crucial for Shankly's legacy.
Oh yeah, and I, without a doubt. I mean, I think in many ways that his greatest achievement was winning the FA Cup, because that was what Liverpool were desperate to do
in '65.
Yeah, and the Everton has won it, and they were second class citizens in the city until that point, and that's when the balance of power...
So even though they won the league the year before, the FA Cup had such sort of glamour and cachet in those days. So.
Yeah.
And that's where the balance started to shift. But winning the UEFA Cup, it turned it completely. And, you know, it made such a difference. I mean, it was in the aftermath of that the scarves come out with, like, Liverpool supporters all over the world with the flags on. It was the sense of being not just a European club, but a global club started to form at that point. Because before that, I mean, it was a fairly parochial backwater in many ways.
Mm.
But now, you know, afterwards, Shankly said, all Europe are scared of us now. Gunter Netzer told me. I'd be surprised if Gunter did. But that was it. Europe did sit up and take notice.
Yeah.
And Mönchengladbach were a good team. I mean, they'd have another appointment with them 4 years later.
Which is also a great stage. Game.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, it's a good note to end on. Tony, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much. That was Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. For more stories like that, do check out blizzard.co.uk. Thank you very much, Jonathan.
Cheers, thank you.
And we'll see you next week, everybody.
a Stakhanov production.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.